I'm Linda Palaccio, host of A Taste of the Past. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
In the early 20th century, the country's food supply was suddenly threatened with an imminent railroad strike. As public agencies responsible for transportation, food supply, and the health of New York City gathered to assess the nature of the threat, they came to realize just how vulnerable the city was to a disruption in food transport and how little they understood about the complexities of how New Yorkers were fed. Although the rail strike never came to pass, the threat led to the publication of the first comprehensive study of New York's food supply and ultimately inspired the book How Great Cities Are Fed by Walter Hedden, published in 1929. While the trends, technology, politics, and personalities have changed, the core issues that define how our cities are fed today are strikingly similar to the key concerns in the early 20th century. Food supply, infrastructure, public health, the role of business, the responsibility of government, and how the dollar is distributed along the value chain. I'm Karen Karp, and this radio show is produced by the great team at Karp Resources. We're a national food and agriculture consultancy based here in New York City. We're grateful to Heritage Radio for giving us the opportunity to bring the nitty-gritty of how great cities are fed to today's food-minded public.
The daily food itself of a tenth of the people in the United States depends upon the efficiency of the New York food distributing system. As a laboratory for the study of urban marketing problems, the Metropolitan District is unsurpassed.
That's Ben Carrick, a consultant with us at Karp Resources. Walter Hedden was, as one book reviewer noted, well qualified by his experience as chief of the Bureau of Commerce for the Port of New York Authority to endeavor in this data-heavy exercise. And he had a marvelous way of quantifying what he learned. For example, in 1920, it would have required a train 8 miles long to bring in our daily supply of food. I happened upon this book about 5 years ago, as our work was getting us deeper into the minutia of some very complicated issues related to food getting to and around New York City. These included school food, and here in New York, that's about 900,000 meals per day, wholesale markets and farmers' relationship to them, and how vast amounts of flour are contracted, milled, and travel to the city's bakeries. Our work with anti-hunger organizations has always kept food security for the city's most vulnerable citizens top of mind, and the events of 9/11 and Superstorm Sandy gives us, and New York City officials, increasing cause for concern about the meager supply of food that we keep and can move around the city during an emergency. It's just about 36 hours worth.
So How Great Cities Are Fed was both academically interesting and immediately practical for our work. Listeners may be surprised to hear that there has not, to our knowledge, been the level of detailed information gathering about our city's food supply since Hedden's work in the 1920s. So, without contemporary analysis to consider, we decided to read this book. We borrowed it from the NYU library, photocopied it, took it on vacation, and began to map out a plan for bringing it to life. We wanted to provide a historic perspective to problems that many think are simply issues of modern times and technology, and to take the long view about feeding people in cities more healthfully, safely, deliciously, and sustainably.
In this series of 12 episodes, we have selected topics from the original 1929 volume that are either surprisingly relevant today or just quirky and fun. Guests on the show, including food industry players, academics, and luminaries, will help us explore the political, social, economic, and gastronomic relationship between agriculture, food, cuisine, and urban life.
In this episode, we are going to frame the relationship between food and cities, put this topic in a historical and policy perspective, and introduce our listeners to some of the key drivers of innovation in the last century, which may, or may not, inform how we approach food issues today. These include the length of supply chains, perishability, technology, and agriculture diversity and population.
How long would that train now be that feeds New York City for a day? We haven't yet done the math. But thank you for joining us to think about how great cities are fed.
So here's another quote from Hedden. Fresh fruits and vegetables for the New York market come principally from three states. California, 3,000 miles west, Florida, 1,000 miles south, and New York State. The average haul on these commodities is 1,500 miles.
Upon reading those words, Matthew DiRigo, vice president and co-owner with his two brothers of DiRigo Brothers Company of New York, wholesale distributors in the Hunts Point produce market in the Bronx, New York, reflected.
My great uncle and grandfather shipped the first freight car of vegetables from California to Boston, from San Jose, California to Boston, one brother to the other. It's one of our little claims of fame in our family lore, but it's fairly well documented. And it basically started the California vegetable deal.
The California vegetable deal, the transcontinental shipping of produce, began in 1926. Should we be surprised by that date? Robin Metcalf, another of our guests, a food historian in the College of Natural Sciences at the University of Texas at Austin, who runs something called the Food Lab, reminds us...
If you look back in history, even to the Roman Empire, there's evidence that the Romans were drawing upon food supplies up into England, the far reaches of their empire.
So why is it that today so many earnest food people, professionals and consumers alike, are, shall we say, incensed about the notion that an average plate travels 1,500 miles from farm to table? What nostalgic ideals are we aspiring to? Did they ever really exist? And were things better for people in cities if they did?
I think it has something to do with the invisible, as opposed to transparent, nature of food chains.
Shana Cohen, a longtime consultant with us at CARP Resources, but also a Fulbright scholar and former project manager for Grow NYC, reflected on this dilemma.
I was thinking about that framed set of postcards that hangs in the CARP Resources office from, I guess, probably the 1910s, 1920s, that includes that statistic that food travels an average of 1,500 miles before arriving on a New York City consumer's plate. When those postcards were made, that might have been something that was celebrated in a lot of ways, of these trade routes, the way that the world was connected.
Celebrated indeed. It was a risky stroke of entrepreneurship that got that first boxcar of broccoli to Boston from San Jose.
I believe it was 1926, and my great uncle was in California buying wine grapes. The two brothers started the firm in 1920 in Boston, and he was out there in 25, and he never came back. He bought 28 acres of land and started DiRigo Brothers of California. The two co-owned DiRigo Mass and DiRigo Cal together, and they were real pioneers in the vegetable industry, and they planted broccoli from seeds they got from Italy, and loaded up a car, stuffed the, they called it bunker ice, the middle of the car was all ice, and the ends were all product, and ran it across the country, and it worked.
Well, we all know about container shipping as being one of those events post the event that you were talking about in the book. That certainly revolutionized global trade and, at the same time, global food, the movement of food around the world.
Hedden and his employers at the Port Authority of New York and folks at the United States Department of Agriculture were very concerned about the lack of diversity in shipping methods of food in the mid-1920s.
Up until the 70s, the entire vegetable world was rail carred here. It was actually cheaper and, I would say, more efficient pound for pound, but less maneuverable.
Indeed, getting product into New York City before the centralization of our terminal markets in the Bronx was an ordeal with challenging maneuvers. Hedden painted a vivid picture of the arrival of a boxcar of oranges to New York City after a cross-country journey from California, through Indiana, and finally ending up in New Jersey.
Running on a fast schedule, the train arrives at Erie's classification yard at Croxton, New Jersey, about 3 miles west of the Hudson River. Here, the cars are classified, and those ordered for immediate delivery are switched to specially assigned tracks for dispatch to the Hudson River waterfront, a distance of 3 miles. Arriving at the waterfront yard, a switch engine pushes the cars down to the floating car ferries. After a float is loaded with cars, a tugboat hooks on and pulls the car float across the river to the Manhattan shore. Upon arrival at the pier, the car float is tied up and the tug casts off.
At that point, gangs of workmen equipped with hand trucks unload the boxes of oranges from the cars to the pier floor. The unloading must be completed by 7 a.m., at which time the fruit buyers are allowed on the piers. At the sound of a gong, At about 8:30 or 9 a.m., they mount the stairs to the auction rooms where auctioneers sell the fruit to the highest bidder.
Okay, so let me make sure I've got that. Our box of oranges has come in on rail, it's been pushed to the waterfront, loaded onto a barge, floated across the Hudson, unpacked by hand and hand truck, and then shuttled by a horse truck off of the pier and loaded onto a motor truck.
And it's not even to the retailer yet. The oranges were moved to the jobbing markets later that day, and the next morning the retailers, pushcart operators, and buyers for retail markets would visit those jobbing markets and make their purchases. Local food is one of the prevailing trends of our time. It can be traced to the early 1980s and has been going strong ever since. Local food is such a dominant part of today's food discussion and has many values attached to it. Flavor, quality, supporting local farmers and local economies, transparency and traceability, putting a face on our food, and sometimes, lagging among the fervor, seasonality.
And what was seasonality like when Hedden was writing?
Seasonality in the early 1920s meant hardship and scarcity. In the Northeast, fresh produce in the winter was a luxury. Hardy winter fruits, such as lemons, grapefruits, and oranges from Florida or California, apples grown in upstate New York, and banana shipments from Central and South America, which began entering the major U.S. ports, including New York, in the early 1800s, were essentially the sole and often monotonous sources of vitamins A and C for many months of the year. We continue to think of these products as lacking seasonality due to their ubiquitous and constant presence in the marketplace. But there are technology and economic stories underlying the shift to a broader market basket that we need to consider.
What happened on the supply side that helped make diets more diverse, offerings more culturally appropriate, and helped plant the seed for the economic growth of our agriculture sector in the U.S.? According to Hedden, no single event in the last century had more significance to the perishable food industry than the successful shipment under ice of a carload of strawberries from Anna, Illinois to Chicago in 1872.
The concurrent dynamics of growing cities, federal policy, industrial development, technological innovation, and plant breeding contributed to the perfect storm of factors that freed consumers from the boredom of seasonality 100 plus years ago. Indeed, for about a century leading up to the date of that first strawberry shipment under ice, and later to the Dorigo Brothers broccoli deal, a lot was happening on the U.S. policy front to create the picture that's now part of the agriculture and food systems vernacular. A little chronology. Many U.S. presidents were involved as policymaking first tried to grasp what kind of agriculture made sense on our terrain. Education was the first order of policy business. After World War I, the U.S. government was intent on boosting agriculture, which was lagging behind other industries in recovering from the war. They believed that a focus on marketing through establishing new organizations, marketing agreements, and co-ops would do a great deal for advancing the interests of farmers.
And actually, Calvin Coolidge was one of the first presidents to speak at length about farmers in his State of the Union address. This is from 1926. In determination of what further measures may be undertaken, it seems to me there are certain pitfalls which must be avoided, and our test in avoiding them should be to avoid disaster to the farmer himself.
The period from 1920 to 1929, known as the Roaring Twenties, were exciting years for the United States. But despite the overtures of Coolidge, U.S. farmers did not share in that prosperity.
They had been overproducing since World War I when Herbert Hoover, the federal government's food administrator at the time, encouraged large increases in American agricultural production during the war to compensate for disrupted production in Europe.
Post-war efforts to support U.S. farmers failed, and their situation worsened throughout the 1920s. U.S. farmers went on producing vast amounts and continued to rely on income from food exports to Europe. But European countries had resumed their own food production after the war, and because of surpluses, prices for U.S. farm products fell dramatically.
Agriculture employed almost a third of the U.S. workforce at that time, and most had to take out loans to buy seed and equipment, borrowing against their land and homes. Food prices continued to fall, and by the time of the 1929 crash, many U.S. farmers were hopelessly in debt.
Chronic overproduction and low prices for farm products were among the top causes of the Great Depression. Farmers began leaving the land, and this trend, plus the shifting federal policies such as labor, agriculture, commerce, and transportation, contributed to the rapid growth of cities in the first quarter of the 20th century. In fact, as Coolidge said in his annual address, it would be difficult to conceive of any modern activity which contributes more to the necessities and conveniences of life than transportation. Without it, our present agricultural production and practically all of our commerce would be completely prostrated. Railroads, growth of, and feeding cities, how do these all tie together?
E.G. Norse, in the foreword to How Great Cities Are Fed, wrote, "The tendency toward further urbanization and the even greater massing of population as apartments multiply, skyscrapers increase their height, and city facilities for rapid transit are improved indicates that the physical and hence the economic task of city food distribution will become heavier rather than lighter."
Indeed, as cities were figuring out how to house people, they were also trying to figure out how to most effectively deal with the vast quantities of food necessary to feed them. Let's go back to that shipment of oranges for a moment. They sound cumbersome, but let's remember that the rail, barge, pier, pallet, and dolly systems
made it possible to move important, if not indispensable, elements of the city's food so rapidly and in such large quantities as actually to facilitate the greater growth of the city itself. It has enormously expanded consumer demand and thus contributed to the growth of those branches of agriculture whose product is marketed in a perishable form.
Along with the transportation and the refrigeration, one of the other things that was basically occurring simultaneously with that were growing practices, seed hybridization, seed advancement. Your seasonality grew earlier and later.
Seasonality in 1926 was not a cause célèbre, but a barrier and then a focus for innovation to feed hungry cities.
People are so spoiled now. They want 12 months a year of everything. And there's just a few things left that are not that way, like cherries, for example, or figs and things like that. There's a passion to seasonality that gets people jazzed up. People get jazzed up about cherries when they're good because they don't get them all the time. They only get them a couple of months out of the year. The ramps are in season now, and everybody's all excited about an onion growing up in New York State. I kind of get a kick out of it because there is a little bit of fashion to produce for sure.
Today, in 2014, we have solved for seasonality by both having year-round supply of nearly everything, as well as a renewed effort to know where our food is coming from and who our food producers are.
New York City, like most major metropolitan areas across the U.S. and the world, is looking at another sharp population spike. 1.5 million more people are expected to be living here in the five boroughs by the year 2030. And between now and then, we will have a great need to solve for the 21st century version of many of the same basic dilemmas we had in the 1920s.
The temptation these days is to think about how we can just improve our existing system rather than really looking at a major disruption and how to recreate or create a new, very different looking food system.
And then, like now, as Hedden so succinctly stated,
it immediately became apparent that there was a dire lack of dependable information regarding the city's food needs, the sources from which they were supplied, and the manner in which these supplies were transported and handled.
There's some really interesting things going on now that aren't simply about improving the system that we feel is broken now, but dramatically changing it up. It might not be beyond the realm of our imagination to think that we will have something similar to a toaster that'll print out what we need, especially if you have some very specific health issues or allergic reactions to certain ingredients.
In forthcoming episodes, we will be looking at more early 20th century innovations such as refrigeration technology for rail and truck, terminology that has helped shape our understanding of what food systems are, the evolution to terminal markets from central city wholesale and retail markets, retail distribution centers, and the consolidation of the retail sector, and the age-old nuisance of how the food dollar gets shared along the supply chain.
We will also be taking cues from the last century to help us think about and explore solutions for the 21st century. Because at the end of the day,
someone really has to solve how to move food through highly congested cities. Whether or not we end up with no cars at all, somehow food has to get there.
I'm Karen Karp.
And I'm Ben Carrick.
For HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.